He kissed her behind the ear. "No, I'm just so happy," she had said. He didn't say that it had been a long day, that he'd had to wait in the drizzle on the street for 2 hours, that after he finally went in and read his lines and went out the door, he'd heard the director say, "Stellar. Too bad he's a giant." That his agent wasn't returning his calls. That he would have relished a nice dinner for once. Because, in truth, he didn't mind. If she was happy, it meant she wouldn't leave him. And it had become painfully apparent over their short marriage that he was not worth the salt she sweated. The woman was a saint. She saved, fretted, somehow paid their bills when he brought in nothing. He had sat beside her until it was fully dark, and she turned with a rustling of silk and kissed him suddenly, and he carried her to bed without eating. Now Mathilde lifted a piece of salmon burger to Lotto's lips, and though he didn't want it, she was looking at him and the gold specks in her eyes glittered, and he took the bite off the fork. He kissed her on the freckled bridge of her nose. "Disgusting," Arnie called from his distant sheet. His arm was around some tattooed chick he was dating from his bar. "You've been married for a year. Honeymoon's over." "Never," Mathilde and Lotto said at once. They did jinx pinkies, kissed again.
"What's it like?" Natalie said quietly. "Marriage, I mean."
Lotto said, "A never-ending banquet, and you eat and eat and never get full." Mathilde said,
"Kipling called it a very long conversation."
Lotto looked at his wife, touched her cheek. "Yes," he said. Cholly leaned toward Danica, who leaned away. He whispered,
"You owe me $1 million."
"What?" she snapped. She was dying for a chicken leg, but had to plow through a heap of salad before she allowed herself anything fatty.
"Last year at their housewarming," Cholly said. "We bet $1 million they'd be divorced by now. You lose."
They looked at Lotto and Mathilde, so handsome, the still axis of the garden, of the spinning world.
"I don't know. How much of it's an act?" Danica said. "There's some sort of darkness there. Probably that he's pretending to be faithful and she's pretending not to care."
"You're mean," Cholly said with admiration. "What's your beef with Lotto? Were you one of his vanquished millions? They all still love him. I ran into that girl Bridget, who was calling herself his girlfriend in college, and she burst into tears when she asked about him. He was the love of her life."
Danica's eyes and mouth tightened. Cholly laughed, revealing a roil of lasagna.
"No, it's the opposite," he said. "He never went for you."
"If you don't shut up, you're getting salad in the kisser," she said.
They sat for a long moment, eating, pretending to eat. Then Danica said,
"Fine, double or nothing, but I get longer, 6 years, until 1998, and they'll be divorced and you'll pay me $2 million and I'll get an apartment in Paris. Enfin."
Cholly blinked, bulged. "You're assuming that I'll be able to pay."
"Of course you will. You're the kind of slimy little man who makes $100 million by your 30s, Danica said.
Cholly said, "That's the nicest thing anyone ever said about me." When the shadows thickened just enough for the gesture to be hidden, Susanna gave Natalie a pinch on the rear. They laughed into their cups. It had been tacitly agreed upon. Another night they would end up at Susanna's. Only Natalie knew about Susanna's new role as the bratty daughter of a soap opera villain. Only Natalie knew about the new rising sea of feeling between them.
"My career would die before it was born if everyone knew I was a big fat lesbo," Susanna had said.
Something sat wrong with Natalie, but she kept it in, let Susanna blaze inside her all day while she stood at her sad gray desk trading commodities, her bank account spinning richer second by second. Natalie was looking better, Lotto thought, watching her brushing her hand over the last mint. She had bleached the mustache, lost weight, was dressing with flair.
She had found the beauty he'd known was there all along. He smiled at her, and she blushed, smiled back. Their eating slowed. The group fell silent. Caramel brownies went around. Some of the friends watched the creamy unfurl of a contrail in the darkling sky, and there was a poignancy in the way it disappeared, and this made most of them think about the dead, black-haired girl, that they'd never again feel her arms around their necks in a hug. She had smelled like oranges. "I found a boy who'd hung himself in prep school," Lotto said suddenly. "Hanged himself." They looked at his face with interest. He was pale, grim. They waited for the story because there was always a story with Lotto. But he didn't say anything more. Mathilde took his hand.
"You never said," she whispered.
"Tell you later," he said. Poor, pustuled jelly roll dangled ghostly in the garden for a breath, and Lotto passed his hand over his face, and the boy was gone. Someone said, "Look, the moon!" And there it was, hove up like a ship in the navy edge of sky, and it filled them all with longing. Rachel sat down beside her brother, leaned into his warmth. She was up for fall break, had pierced her ears all the way around, and wore her hair long in front, shaved in the rear. Radical for a 10-year-old, but she needed to do something, otherwise she looked a slight 6 with jittery hands, and from her studies of her cohort, she understood that it was better to be weird than twee. Smart girl. Yes. She had just gone in and put the envelope with her last year's allowance in Mathilde's underwear drawer, dabbling her hands among the silks. It had not escaped Rachel that her brother's cabinets were bare, that Mathilde had called Sally last month, that Sally had sent cash. Now she was watching the window on the first floor where she had seen a fluttering edge of curtain, half a fist, one eye. Rachel pictured an interior with wallpapered ceilings, cats with infirmities, cyclops cats, and cats with nubs for tails and gouty, swollen-pawed cats. Stink of joint rub. Bowl of minestrone heated in the microwave. Sad old woman inside. Mavo was heading fast toward that same future, the tiny pink beach house a tomb of figurines and chintz. Mavo loved the sound of the sea, she told Rachel, but Rachel had never even seen her go out into the sand. She just stayed in her little pink aquarium of a house, like a suckerfish, gobble-mouthing the glass. Poor Mavo. "I will never be old," Rachel promised herself. "I will never be sad. I'd scarf a cyanide capsule first, kill myself like that friend of Lotto's everyone is crying about. Life isn't worth living unless you are young and surrounded by other young people in a beautiful, cold garden perfumed by dirt and flowers and fallen leaves, gleaming in the string of lights, listening to the quiet city on the last fine night of the year." Under the dying angel's trumpet plant, the old lady's tabby watched. Confusing, these people lounging around their food like enormous cats sated from the kill. She longed to pad in and investigate, but there were too many of them, and they were so sudden, so unpredictable. Just so, at once the people rose, shrieking, gathering things up in their arms, rushing about. The cat was startled that they were startled, because she had smelled the rain long before she heard it. A spoon fell from a bowl of tabbouleh and spun into the dirt and was abandoned, spattered by the mud kicked up by the first raindrops. The people were gone. A hand came out of a ground-level window and unplugged the tree lights. In the plunge of darkness, the yellow cord writhed into the window like a snake, and the cat hungered to chase it. But it disappeared, and the window closed. The cat dabbed her paw delicately at one fat drop on the edge of a leaf, then galloped across the yard and came inside. The door to the apartment opened. In leapt the goblin. It was 9 at night, unseasonably cold. Behind the goblin came Miss Piggy, a skeleton, a ghost. Albert Einstein, moonwalking. Samuel came in wearing a lampshade for a hat, a cardboard box painted to resemble a bedside table, with a magazine and 2 condom wrappers glued on top. Lotto in a toga, crowned by gilded bay leaves, put his beer down on Samuel's tabletop, and said, "Hello, you're a nightstand. A one-night stand. Ha ha." A murdered prom queen frou-frou'd by, muttering, "Wishful thinking." Samuel said, "I think that was my ex-girlfriend." Grinned, went to the fridge for a beer.
"Since when does it snow on Halloween? Global warming, schmobile schwarming," Luann said, stomping her boots on the rattan mat. She was Mathilde's friend from the gallery where they worked, and was painted up cleverly as Picasso's Dora Maar, the one with the bitten apple for a cheek. She kissed Lotto lingeringly, saying, "Oh, hail yes, Caesar." He laughed too loudly, pulling away. Luann was trouble. Mathilde came home most days with stories about how she tried to seduce their boss, some gross, bulgy-eyed man with vaudeville eyebrows named Ariel. "Why?" said Lotto. "She's pretty. She's young. She could do way better." And Mathilde shot him a look and said, "Babe, he's rich." And, of course, that explained it. Together, Lotto and Luann went toward Mathilde, who was resplendent in full Cleopatra, eating a cupcake beside the huge brass Buddha on the mantel, adorned with sunglasses and lei. Lotto dipped his wife and licked the crumbs from her lips as she laughed.
"Yuck," Luann said. "You guys can't be freaking real."
She went to the kitchen, took a Zima from the fridge, moodily sipped, made a face. She'd gauged the low state of Lotto's mind by the size of his belly and how crowded the apartment was with used books. In his low moments, reading was all Lotto could do. Funny, because he seemed like such a huge goofball, and then he opened his mouth and quoted paragraphs of Wittgenstein or something. It unnerved her, the gap between who he appeared to be and the person he held inside him. Someone put on a Nirvana CD, and girls got up from the leather couch Lotto had rescued from the sidewalk. They attempted to dance, but gave up. Put Thriller on again. Cholly, Green Goblin, sidled up to Lotto and Mathilde, slurringly drunk.
"I never noticed how close set your eyes are, Mathilde, and how wide yours are, Lotto."
He made a stabbing motion with two fingers at Mathilde, and said,
"Predator?"
Then stabbed at Lotto and said,
"Prey."
"I'm the prey and Mathilde's the predator?" Lotto said. "Please, I'm her predator. Her sexual predator," he said, and everyone groaned. Luann was gazing at Arnie across the room. She made an impatient motion with her hand.
"Shut up, you guys," she said. "I'm ogling."
Mathilde sighed, backed away.
"Wait, who?"
"Oh, Arnie," Charlie said, spiteful. "Disappointed?"
"Please, he's so stupid."
"Dumb as a dead bulb," Luann said. "Exactly my point."
"Arnie," said Lotto. "Arnie was a neuroscience major in college. He's no dumbo. Just because he didn't go to Harvard like you doesn't make him dumb."
"I don't know. Maybe he's pickled his brains with booze," Luann said. "At your last party, I overheard him say that Sting is his spirit animal."
Lotto gave a whistle across the room. Arnie, as the Hulk, looked up from the sea of girls for whom he was making chocolate martinis. He made his way over to Lotto, clapping him on the shoulder. Charlie and Arnie were both painted green. Side by side, Arnie was the pneumatic before, and Charlie the punctured after. Lotto told Arnie, "Luann said she'd jump your bones if you can define hermeneutics in a satisfactory manner." And he steered the two into the bedroom, closed the door.
"God," Charlie said, "I'd die."
"They haven't come out of the room yet," said Lotto. "Some Cupid kills with arrows, some with traps."
"Shakespeare again?"
Charlie said. "Forever," Lotto said. Charlie stalked away. Lotto was alone. When he looked up, he saw only himself reflected in the night-blackened windows, the belly that had developed during his blue summer this year, the shine at the temples where his hair was going. 3.5 years out of college, and Mathilde was still paying the bills. Lotto rubbed the Buddha's head sadly and walked past a covey of witches huddled over someone's Polaroid paper, faces summoned out of the murk. Mathilde's back was turned, and she was speaking low to Susanna. Lotto crept forward and knew she was talking about him.
Better. Coffee commercial in September. Father and toddler out on a fishing boat at dawn. Apparently the kid fell in, and Lotto fished him out with an oar and saved his life. Our hero.
They laughed together, and Susanna said,
I know, Folgers, I've seen it. Dawn, a cabin in the woods, the kid waking up on a rowboat. He's so striking, Lotto, especially with a beard.
Tell all the directors you know, get him a job, Mathilde said, and Susanna said,
for what?
And Mathilde said,
anything at all,
and Susanna gave a half-mouthed smile and said, I'll see what I can do. Lotto, stung, hurried away without letting them see him. Mathilde was never unkind, but she wore her passive aggression like a second skin. If she didn't like her food at a restaurant, she wouldn't touch it, keeping her eyes low and saying nothing until Lotto was forced to tell the waiter the food was too salty or undercooked, and could they please have something else, thanks so much, buddy. She once maneuvered an invitation to a wedding in Martha's Vineyard by standing next to the bride all night, a big-time Broadway actress, smiling gently but not speaking a word until the bride impulsively asked them to come. They attended, danced. He charmed a producer and got a call back for a revival of My Fair Lady. Though his voice was not great, and he didn't get the role. They sent the actress a very nice set of antique silver grapefruit spoons they'd bought in the thrift store and polished to appear expensive. Up before Lotto rose a vision of himself as if attached to 100 shining strings by his fingers, eyelids, toes, the muscles of his mouth. All the strings led to Mathilde's pointer finger, and she moved it with the subtlest of twitches and made him dance. The Cholly Goblin came to a stop next to Mathilde, and together they watched Lotto across the room in a ring of boys. A bottle of bourbon hung between the hook of two fingers. The gold circlet of leaves flapped off the back of his head.
"What's eating your ass?" Cholly said. "You seem off."
Mathilde sighed, said,
"There's something wrong with him."
"I think he's fine," Cholly said. "We only have to worry if he's way up or way down. He's coming out of the dip from the summer."
He paused, watched Lotto.
"At least he's losing his pot belly."
"Thank God," she said. "All summer I thought he was about to jump in front of a train. He needs to get a roll. Some days he never leaves the apartment."
She shook herself resolutely.
"Anyway, how's the used car business?"
"Quit," Cholly said. "I'm in real estate now. In 15 years, I'll own half of Manhattan."
"Right," Mathilde said. Then, suddenly, "I'm leaving the gallery."
They both looked startled.
"Okay," Cholly said. "Who'll support the genius?"
"I'll work. I got a job in some internet startup, a dating site. Begin in a week. I haven't told anyone yet, not Luann or Ariel or Lotto. It's just, I needed a change. I thought my future would be in art. It's not."
"Is it in the internet?"
"All of our futures," she said, "exist in the internet."
They smiled together into their drinks.
"Why are you telling me?" said Cholly after some time. "I mean, I'm a weird choice of a confidant. You know?"
"Don't know," Mathilde said. "I can't tell if you're benign or malignant. But I feel like I could tell you all my secrets right now, and you'd keep them to yourself, waiting for when best to deploy them."
Cholly went very still, watchful.
"Tell me all your secrets," he said.
"Fat chance," she said. She left Cholly and went across to her husband and whispered in his ear. Lotto's eyes widened, and he bit down on a grin
and didn't watch his wife as she went around the party and out the apartment's front door, turning down the dimmer switch on her way so that the only illumination in the room was from the flicker of the jack-o'-lanterns. In a minute, Lotto went out the door with ostentatious nonchalance. He went up a flight of stairs, found Mathilde outside the old lady's door. His party churned below. From within, he hadn't been aware it was so loud. He wondered why the old lady hadn't called the cops yet, as she usually did. Still before 10, perhaps. There was a flush of cold as the front door opened and a clump of clowns clattered down the stairs to their apartment, and Lotto's exposed buttocks prickled with goosebumps. But the front door closed, the door to their apartment opened, and swallowed the clowns. He loosed Mathilde's left breast from her bustier, his mouth on the curve of her throat. He turned her around to press her cheek against the door, but she struggled back, her eyes flashing, and he submitted to the standing missionary. Not as exciting, perhaps, but still a prayer to the gods of love. Inside the second-floor apartment, Bette was eating a runny egg sandwich alone in the dark, kept up by the festivities below. Now, unmistakable, a creak on the stairway, and Bette thrilled to the thought of a burglar, the tiny gun she kept in the fern stand. She put the sandwich down and pressed her ear to the door. But here was another creaking, a murmur, some preparatory thumps. Indeed. This was happening. It had been so very long since her Hugh, but what had passed between them still felt fresh to her, a peach bitten into. Felt like yesterday, all that bodily joy. Begun so young they didn't even know what they were doing, and they wouldn't give it up, so when they were old enough, they married. Not the worst thing to build a marriage around, such juice. The first years had been delirious, the latter ones merely happy. The girl on the landing moaned in her chest. The boy was muttering, but not so distinctly that Bette could understand the words, and the girl's moans became louder, then were muffled as if she were biting something. His shoulder? The rattling of the door was strenuous. Bette pushed herself against the heaving wood. So long since anyone had touched her, she offered up her change on her palm at the grocery store so that the clerk would brush her hand with his fingers. Such athletes! Put Bette in mind of the monkey house on a Sunday visit to the zoo, the capuchin's gleeful whoring. A mingled half-shout, and Bette whispered to her tabby figure-aiding her ankles. Trick-or-treat, old girl. Indeed. Out on the landing was hoarse breathing and rustling in those silly creatures. Oh, she knew who it was, the strange-looking giant from downstairs, and his tall, plain wife, though she would pretend that she didn't to save embarrassment when they met in the foyer. Then the footsteps down, away, the music intensifying, quieting as their door closed, and Bette was alone again. Now for a stiff scotch and a toddle off to bed, Dovey, like the good girl you've become. 10 o'clock, and Mathilde was on her knees picking up the pieces of their millionth shattered wine glass since they moved into this dismal apartment 5 years ago. After all this time, still goodwill crap. Someday, when Lotto got a gig, they'd afford better. Oh, she was tired. She hadn't even bothered to put in her contacts tonight, and her glasses lenses were smeared with fingerprints. She longed for everyone to go home. She heard Lotto say from the couch, "An attempt to shake things up. At least it's not as bright as a mouthful of lemon heads anymore." Rachel stroked the freshly painted wall. She muttered, "What's this color? Suicide at dusk? Church on a winter afternoon? It's the darkest blue I've ever seen." She seemed even more nervy than normal. A car had just backfired on the street, and she'd dropped the glass. "Please let me do that," she said sheepishly to Mathilde. "I'm such a klutz," she said. "I've got it, and I can hear you about the new paint, you know. I love it," Mathilde called out, letting the pieces of glass rain into the garbage. But a drop of blood fell onto the mess. She had sliced her index without feeling it. "Fuck," she whispered. "I love it, too," Luann said. She had plumpened in the past year like dough before the second punchdown.
I mean, at least as a background for that stolen painting, it's nice.
Stop saying that, Mathilde said. Pitney smashed it, Ariel told me to throw it out. And I did. If I picked it up out of the dumpster later, it was fair game.
Luann shrugged, but her smile was tight. With all due respect, Charlie said, this is the worst party in the history of parties. We're talking about walls. Susanna and Natalie are making out, and Danica's asleep on the rug. What possessed you to have a wine-tasting party? What 20-something knows balls about wine? We went to better parties in high school.
Lotto smiled, an effect like dawn. The others perked up.
We were wild, Lotto said. He turned to the others and said, I only lived in Crescent Beach for a few months before Charlie debauched me and my mom sent me away to prep school. But it was the best. We stayed up all night, pretty much every night. I can't even tell you how many drugs we did. Chaw, remember that party up in the old abandoned house by the marsh? I was screwing a girl on the roof when I realized the house was on fire and hurried things up and rolled off her and fell two stories into a bush, and when I crawled out, my peen was out of my fly. The fireman gave me a round of applause.
The others laughed, and Lotto said,
that was the very last night I ever spent in Florida. My mom shipped me off the next day.
She'd promised an enormous gift to the school. Screw admissions criteria. Haven't been back home since.
Charlie gave a choked noise. They looked at him.
My twin sister, he said.
It was.
You were screwing.
Shoot, Lotto said.
I'm so sorry, Chaw. I'm such a jerk.
Charlie took a deep breath, let it out.
That was the night I broke my leg in a spiral fracture when we were pre-partying on the beach. I was in surgery when all the other stuff happened.
Long silence.
I'm so embarrassed, Lotto said.
Don't worry, Charlie said. She'd already fucked the whole soccer team by then.
Charlie's date made a stricken sound. She was a downy model from some USSR country whose beauty, Lotto had to admit, cast even Mathilde's into the shade. Not difficult these days.
Lotto looked across to his wife standing in the kitchen. How bedraggled she was, her hair unwashed, and her glasses and sweatshirt. He shouldn't have insisted on the get-together. But he had been worried about her. For weeks she had been quiet, remote. Something was wrong. Nothing he said was right, none of the jokes. Was it her job, he'd finally asked? If she was so unhappy, she should quit and they should start a family. If he gave Antoinette a grandbaby, they'd be reinstated for sure. They'd have plenty of money then, geez, enough for Mathilde to relax a little, figure out what it was she really wanted to do with her life. She struck him as an artist who'd never found her medium, restlessly testing this and that, but unable to find a way to articulate her urgency. Maybe she'd find it in children. But...
Oh my God, Lotto, stop, please, stop talking, stop your endless talking, stop about having babies, she'd hissed.
And it was true they were still too young. Too few of their friends had spawned, at least intentionally. And so he'd tabled the discussion and distracted her with videos and booze. He'd had the idea that a wine-tasting party would cheer her, but it was clear that all she wanted to do was go to their new mattress, the bedroom with the embroidered curtains, the antique etchings of nests, and bury herself there. He had forced tonight on her. The panic deepened. What if she was getting ready to leave him? What if her dark span wasn't about her, but rather about him? He knew he'd disappointed her. What if she knew she could do better? He opened his arms to her, more to console himself, but she only brought over a paper towel so he could fashion a bow around her bleeding finger.
I don't know. I think this is fun, said Rachel.
Loyal Rachel, with the sharp little face, hungry eyes. She was down in the city from her prep school for the weekend. Barely 14 years old, but she looked weary. Her nails were bitten beyond the quick, Lotto noticed. He'd have to ask Sally if there was anything going on with her that he should know about.
I'm learning a lot. Beats Friday night's all-dorm slumber party for sure.
I can imagine. Bottle of peppermint schnapps, the breakfast club on the VCR. Someone would be crying in the bathroom all night long. Midnight streaking across the quad. The game of all girls spin the bottle. My Rachel reading a book in the corner in her lobster print pajamas, judging them all like a mini queen, Lotto said. The review in her journal would be devastating.
Rachel said, "Disappointing, trite, and vapid. Two thumbs down."
They chuckled, the knot of desperation in the room gently loosed. This gentling would be Rachel's effect, not a flashy gift, but good. In the silence afterward, Luann said,
"Of course there were professional ethics that should have precluded you taking the canvas, Mathilde."
"For fuck's sake," Mathilde said. "It'd have been all right had someone else dug it from the dumpster? You? What is it, Luann? You're jealous?"
Luann made a face. Of course she was jealous. It must have been so hard for Luann, Lotto thought, back when Mathilde worked at the gallery. Mathilde was always the second in charge. Knowledgeable, clever, gracious. Surely Ariel had favored Mathilde. Everyone favored Mathilde.
"Huh," Luann said. "That's hilarious. Jealous of you?"
"Please stop," said Charlie. "If it had been a Picasso, everyone would have praised Mathilde for her foresight. You're being a total vagina."
"You're calling me a vagina? I don't even know who you are," Luann said.
"We've met a million times. You say that every time," Charlie said. Danica was watching the argument as if it were a game of ping pong. She'd lost even more weight. Her arms and cheeks were downy with strange fur. She was laughing.
"Please stop fighting," Rachel said quietly.
"I don't know why I come to your stupid freaking parties anyway," Luann said, standing. She started to cry with anger.
"You're a total fake, Mathilde, and you know what I'm talking about."
She turned toward Lotto and said, venomously,
"Not you, Lotto. You're just a freaking Bambi. Anybody but you would understand by this point you don't have enough talent for the stage. But nobody wants to hurt you by saying it. Least of all your wife, who thrives on making you a freaking infant in your own life."
Lotto was out of his chair so fast the blood fled from his head.
"Shut your pig face, Luann. My wife is the best human being on the planet, and you know it."
Rachel said,
"Lotto!"
And Mathilde said, low,
"Lotto, stop."
And Natalie and Susanna said,
"Hey!"
Only Charlie burst into high-pitched laughter. Olga, whom they had all forgotten, whipped around and socked him hard on the shoulder, then stood and clattered across the floor in her high heels, threw open the apartment door, shouted,
"You are monsters!"
and stormed up to the street. The frigid wind blew down the stairs from the front door and spangled them with snowflakes. For a long moment, nothing. Then Mathilde said,
"Go after her, Charlie."
"Nah," he said. "She won't get far without her jacket."
"It's 10 below, you fuck," said Danica,
and threw Olga's synthetic fur at Charlie's face. He got up grumbling and went out, slamming both doors. Mathilde rose and lifted the painting off the wall, over the shining pate of the brass Buddha, and handed it to Luann. Luann looked at the painting in her hands. She said,
"I can't take this."
The others in the room had the sense of a ferocious battle being fought in the silence. Mathilde sat, folded her arms, closed her eyes. Luann put the painting against Mathilde's knees. She went out, and the door closed on her forever. In her absence, the room seemed brighter. Even the overhead lights mellowed. The friends left, one by one. Rachel shut herself into the bathroom, and they could hear the bath running. When they were alone, Mathilde knelt in front of Lotto and took off her glasses and buried her face in his chest. He held her helplessly, making soothing sounds. Conflict nauseated him. He couldn't bear it. His wife's thin shoulders shook But when at last she lifted her head, he was startled. Her face was flushed and swollen, but she was laughing.
Laughing?
Lotto kissed the plum presses under her eyes, the freckles on her pale skin. He felt a vertiginous awe.
You called Luann a pig face, she said. You, Mr. Genial, leaping in to save the day. Ha!
Marvelous girl. He saw, with a warm rush, that she would come through this period of stringiness and woe so terrible she couldn't share it with him. She would return. She would love him again. She wouldn't leave. And in every place where they lived from then on, that painting would blow the air. It would be a testament. Their marriage picked itself up off the ground, stretched, looked at them with its hands on its hips. Mathilde was coming back to Lotto. Hallelujah.
Hallelujah, Charlie said, knocking back an eggnog, mostly brandy. It was 11 o'clock. Christ is born.
He and Lotto were silently competing to see who could be drunker. Lotto hid it better, seemed normal, but the room spun if he didn't blink it straight. Outside, a thickness of night. Streetlights were lollipops of bright snow. Aunt Sally hadn't stopped talking for hours, and now she was saying,
"Course, I don't know nothing, being not sophisticated as all y'all bachelor artists, and I sure as heck can't tell you what to do, Lotto, my boy. But if it was me, which it isn't, I know, but if it was, I'd say I done gave it my all, be mighty proud of the 3-4 plays I done these past years, and say, well, not everybody can be Richard Burton, and maybe I got something else I can do with my life. Like maybe, oh, take over the trust or something. Get back in Antoinette's graces. Get undisinherited. You know she's faring poorly, that sick heart of hers. Rachel and you both stand to gain a lot when she passes. God forbid it be soon."
She looked at Lotto cannily over her canary's beak. The Buddha laughed in silence from the mantelpiece. Around him, a lushness of poinsettias. Below, a fire Lotto had dared to make out of sticks collected from the park. Later there would be a chimney fire, a sound of wind like a rushing freight train, and the trucks arriving in the night.
"I'm struggling," Lotto said. "Maybe. But come on. I was born wealthy, white, and male. I'd have nothing to work with if I don't have a little struggle. I'm doing what I love. That's not nothing."
It sounded mechanical, even to his own ears.
"Bad acting, Lotto."
"But acting has slipped away from him a little, hasn't it?" His heart wasn't in the fight anymore.
"What's success, anyway?" said Rachel. "I say it's being able to work as much as you want at whatever lights you up. Lotto's had steady work all these years."
"I love you," Lotto said to his sister. She was in high school, as skinny as Sally.
She took after the sadder white side, dark and hairy and ill-favored. Her friends couldn't believe that Lotto and she were related. Only Lotto thought her stunning, plainer. Her thin face reminded him of Giacometti's sculptures. She never smiled anymore. He pulled her close and kissed her, feeling how tightly she was coiled inside.
"Success is money," Charlie said. "Duh."
"Success," Sally said, "is finding your greatness, hush puppies. Lotto, you were born with it. I saw it the moment you came screaming out of Antoinette, middle of a hurricane. You're simply not listening to what your greatness is. Gawain told me he always thought you'd be the president of the USA or an astronaut. Something bigger than big. It's in your stars."
"Sorry to disappoint you," Lotto said. "And my stars."
"Well, you also disappointed our dead father," Rachel said, laughing.
"To our disappointed dead father," Lotto said. He raised his glass at his sister and swallowed the bitterness. It wasn't her fault. She'd never known Gawain, didn't know what pain she'd summoned. Mathilde came back in the door, carrying a tray. Glorious in her silver dress, her hair platinum, in a Hitchcock twist,
She'd gotten fancy since she'd been promoted 6 months earlier. Lotto wanted to take her into the bedroom and engage in some vigorous frustration abatement. "Save me," he mouthed, but his wife wasn't paying attention.
"I'm worried."
Mathilde put the tray down on the counter in the kitchen, turned to them.
"I left this up there for Beth this morning, and it's 11, and she hasn't touched it. Has anyone seen her the last few days?"
Silence. The clicking of the heirloom clock Sally had brought as a carry-on in her duffel. They all looked ceilingward, as if to see beyond the layers of plaster and floorboard and carpet into the cold, dark apartment. Silence save for the refrigerator hum, a large cold lump on the bed, the only thing breathing the hungry tabby rubbing against the window.
"Em," Lotto said, "it's Christmas. She probably left yesterday for some relative's place, forgot to tell us. Nobody's alone on Christmas."
"Mother is," Rachel said. "Mother's alone in her dank little beach house, watching the whales with her binocs." "Bull honky. Your mother had her choice, and she chose her agoraphobia over spending Christ's birthday with her children. Believe me, I know it's a disease. I live with it every dang day. I don't know why every year I buy her a ticket. This year she even packed. Put on her jacket, her perfume. Then just sat on the couch. She said she'd rather organize the photo boxes in the spare bathroom. She made her own choice, and she's a grown woman. We can't feel bad,"
Aunt Sally said, but her pinched lips belied her words. Lotto felt a rush of relief. Her scratching at him tonight, her picking and prodding, arose from her own guilt.
"I don't feel bad," said Rachel,
but her face was also drawn.
"I do," Lotto said quietly. "I haven't seen my mother for a long time. I feel very bad."
Charlie heaved a sarcastic sigh. Sally glared at him.
"Well, it's not like you kids can't go see her," Sally said. "I know she cut you off, but all you have to do is spend 5 minutes with her and she'll love you both. And that's a promise. I can make it happen."
Lotto opened his mouth, but there was too much to say, and it was all sour toward his mother, un-Christmassy, and so he shut it and swallowed the words back. Mathilde put a bottle of red wine down hard.
"Listen, Antoinette's never been inside this apartment. She has never met me. She chose to be angry and stay angry. We can't be sorry for her choices."
Lotto saw her hands trembling. Rage, he realized. He loved the rare times she showed how thin her calm surface was, how beneath she boiled. A perverse part of Lotto, it's true, wanted to lock Mathilde and his mother in a room and let them claw it all out. But he wouldn't do it to Mathilde. She was far too sweet to spend even a minute in his mother's company without coming out maimed. She turned off the chandelier so the Christmas tree with its lights and glass icicles overcame the room, and he pulled her onto his lap.
"Breathe," Lotto said softly into his wife's hair.
Rachel blinked in the tree's gleam. Sally had been speaking hard truths, he knew. It had become evident over the past year that he could no longer count on his charm, which had faded. He tested it again and again on coffee baristas and audition gauntlets and people reading in the subway. But beyond the leeway given to any moderately attractive young man, he didn't have it anymore. People could look away from him these days. For so long, he had thought it was just a switch he could flick. But he had lost it, his mojo, his juju, his radiance. Gone, the easy words. He could not remember a night when he didn't fall asleep drunk. And so he opened his mouth and began to sing. Jingle Bells, a song he hated, and he was never the world's best tenor anyway. But what else was there to do but sing in the face of dismay, the image of his fat mother sitting up alone by a potted majestic palm strung in colored bulbs? The others now were joining in, miraculous, all of them save Mathilde, still rigid with anger, though even she was softening, a smile cracking her lips. At last, even she sang. Sally watched Lotto, cleaving. Her boy, heart of her heart. She was clear-eyed, knew that Rachel, being of finer moral stock, kinder, humbler, deserved her affection more than Lotto. But it was for Lotto that Sally woke praying. These years of distance were hard on her. In a one-horse open sleigh. It came back to her now, the Christmas before he'd finished college, before Mathilde, when he had met Sally and Rachel in Boston, where they stayed at a redoubtable ancient hotel and were snowed in under 3 feet of powder, like being stuck in a dream. Lotto had maneuvered a rendezvous with a girl at another table at dinner, his smoothness so like his mother's when she was young and lovely that it took Sally's breath away. Antoinette, undulating, had for a moment been superimposed on her son. Later, Sally waited in ambush until midnight, standing at the diamond window at the end of the hallway where their rooms were, the endless snow falling into the common at her back. "O'er the fields we go." At the other end, in minuscule, three housemaids with their trolleys were laughing, shushing one another. At last, her boy's door opened, and he emerged, bare but for a pair of running shorts. Such a beautiful, long back he had. His mother's, at least when she was thin. There was a towel around his neck. He was going up to the pool. The sin he intended to enact so painfully obvious that Sally's cheeks burned in imagining the girl's buttocks gritted with tile marks, Lotto's knees scabby in the morning. Where did he learn such confidence, she thought, as he became smaller, going toward the housemaids? He said something, and all three peeled, and one gave him a little flick with a cloth, and another sent a slow glitter, chocolates, at his chest. Laughing all the way. Ha, ha, ha. He caught them. His laugh rumbled back to Sally. How ordinary he was becoming, she'd thought. He was turning banal. If he wasn't careful, some sweet girl would glue herself to him, Sally saw, and Lotto would drift into marriage, a job as some high-paid menial, a family, Christmas cards, a beach house, middle-aged flab, grandchildren, too much money, boredom, death. He'd be faithful and conservative in old age, blind to his privilege. When Sally stopped crying, she found herself alone, the cold draft of the window at her neck, and on both sides the rows of doors went on and on, diminishing to nothing at the end. What fun it is to ride and sing a sleighing song tonight, oh! But glories! Mathilde came. And though she appeared to be the self-same sweet girl Sally had been afraid of, she was not. Sally saw the flint in her. Mathilde could save Lotto from his own laziness, Sally had thought. But here they were, years later, and he was still ordinary. The chorus caught in her throat. A stranger hurrying as fast as he could over the icy sidewalks looked in. He saw a circle of singing people bathed in the clean white light from a tree, and his heart did a somersault, and the image stayed with him, it merged with him even as he came home to his own children, who were already sleeping in their beds, to his wife crossly putting together the tricycle without the screwdriver that he'd run out to borrow. It remained long after his children ripped open their gifts and abandoned their toys and puddles of paper and grew too old for them and left their house and parents and childhoods, so that he and his wife gaped at each other in bewilderment as to how it had happened so terribly swiftly. All those years, the singers in the soft light in the basement apartment crystallized in his mind, became the very idea of what happiness should look like. Almost midnight, and Rachel couldn't get over the ceiling. What chutzpah had made Mathilde gild it? Their bodies echoed, globs in the brightness above. It did transform the room, shining elegantly against the dark walls. On this frigid last day of the year, it seemed a hand had peeled back the roof, like the lid of a sardine can, and they were standing beneath an August sun. It was unbelievable that this was the same empty white space that she had walked into on the day of their housewarming party more than 7 years earlier, with its wild roil of bodies and beer stink, the glorious sweaty heat, and the garden radiant with early summer light out the windows. Now there were icicles shining in the streetlights. There were orchids around the Buddha, overgrown money plants in the corners, Louis XIV's chairs covered in French flower sacking. It was elegant, overstuffed, too beautiful. A gilded cage, Rachel thought. Mathilde had been short with Lotto all evening. She no longer smiled when she looked at him. Well, she barely looked at him. Rachel was afraid that Mathilde, whom Rachel loved as dearly as anyone, was about to bust out of it all in a commotion of wings. Poor Lotto. Poor all of them if Mathilde left him. Rachel's new girlfriend, Elizabeth, a girl so pale of hair and skin she seemed made of paper, felt Rachel's nerves ratcheting up and squeezed her shoulder. The tension went out of Rachel. She took a wobbly breath and kissed Elizabeth shyly on the neck. Outside, the swift passing of a cat body on the sidewalk. It couldn't be the tabby owned by the old lady from upstairs. That cat had been ancient when Lotto and Mathilde had moved in. Last Christmas it starved for 3 days, until Lotto and Mathilde got a hold of the landlord vacationing in the British Virgin Islands and had someone investigate. Poor, rotted, dead Bet. Lotto had to take a hysterical Mathilde to Samuel's apartment for a week just to get her to calm down while the fumigators were in. Strange to witness composed Mathilde lose it. It made Rachel see her as the thin, big-eyed little girl she must have been. Made Rachel love her even more. Now there was a couple with a new baby up there, which was why this New Year's Eve party tonight was so small. Newborns, apparently, dislike noise. "Breeders," said Mathilde, out of nowhere. Mathilde, who could read minds. She laughed at the astonished face Rachel made, then returned to the kitchen, pouring champagne into glasses on the silver tray. Lotto thought of the baby upstairs, then the way Mathilde would look when pregnant, svelte as a girl from behind, but in silhouette as if she'd swallowed a calabash. He laughed at the thought, her strap down, breast lolling out, fat enough for even his hungry mouth. Days expanding outward from clean, warm skin and milk. That was what he wanted, exactly that. Charlie and Danica and Susanna and Samuel sat quietly, pale, serious-ish. They had come alone to the party, this year bad for breakups. Samuel was skinny, his skin cracked around his mouth. This was the first he'd been out since having surgery for testicular cancer. He seemed, for the first time, diminished.
"Speaking of breeders, last week I saw that girl you dated in college, Lotto. What was her name?"
"Bridget," Susanna said.
"Pediatric oncology fellow. Hugely pregnant. Swollen like a tick. She seems happy."
"I didn't date in college," Lotto said. "Except for Mathilde. For 2 weeks. Then we eloped." "Didn't date. Just fucked every girl in the Hudson Valley." Samuel laughed.
Chemo had suddenly balded him. Without his curls, he looked newly ferret-like.
"Sorry, Rachel, but your brother was a slut."
"Yeah, yeah, I've heard," Rachel said. "I think that Bridget girl used to come to your parties when you first moved in here. She was so boring. You always packed about 1 million people in this room. I miss those days."
Up there rose the ghosts of parties, of themselves when they were younger, too dumb to understand that they were ecstatic. Whatever happened to all those friends of ours? Lotto wondered. The ones who had seemed so essential had faded away. Nerd princes with their twins and strollers, Park Slope and craft beers. Arnie, who owned a bar empire, still doing girls with plates in their ears and jailhouse tattoos. Natalie, now a CFO of some internet startup in San Francisco. 100 others faded off. The friends had been whittled down. The ones who remained were heartwood, marrow.
"I don't know," Susanna was saying softly. "I guess I like living alone."
She was still a teenager in the soap opera. She'd be a teenager until they killed her off, and then she'd play mothers and wives. Women in narratives were always defined by their relations.
"I get so sad sleeping alone," Danica said. "I want to buy a sex doll just to wake up next to someone in the morning.
Data model, same thing, Charlie said.
I hate your face, Charlie, Danica said, trying not to laugh.
Yada yada, Charlie said. Keep singing that same old song. We both know the truth.
Less than a minute until the ball drops, called Mathilde, carrying in the tray of champagne.
Everyone looked at Samuel, who shrugged. Even cancer couldn't dent him. Poor one ball Samuel, Lotto said. He'd gotten into the bourbon after dinner and hadn't recovered yet.
Old single dingle?
Charlie suggested, but not unkindly for once.
Half sack Sam, Mathilde said, and kicked lightly at Lotto, who was stretched out on the couch.
He sat up, yawned. He'd unbuttoned his pants. 30, at the end of his youth. He felt the darkness settle on him again and said,
This is it, you guys. The last year of humanity. Next New Year's it'll be Y2K, and all the planes will fall out of the sky, and the computers will explode, and the nuclear power plants will go offline, and we'll all see a flash, and then the great blank whiteness will come over all of us. Done. Finito. The human experiment. So live it up. It's the last year we get.
He was joking. He believed what he was saying. He thought of how the world without humans would be more brilliant, greener, teeming with strange life. Rats with opposable thumbs, monkeys in spectacles, mutant fish building palaces below the sea. How, in the grand scheme of things, it would be better without human witness anyway. He thought of his mother's young face flickering in candlelight, in revelation.
And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration.
Lotto whispered, and his friends looked at him, saw something terrible, looked away. He broke Rachel's fucking heart. Her whole family broke her fucking heart. Mother burying herself in solitude, in unhappiness. Dog-like Sally slaving away. Lotto, whose pride she couldn't understand. Only a child could stay so angry so long. Only a child wouldn't forgive in order to make things right. Mathilde saw Rachel's eyes fill with pity and shook her head slightly. No. He'll see it.
30 seconds,
Mathilde said. Prince was playing from the computer, of course. Charlie leaned toward Danica, angling for the midnight kiss. Horrible little man. Such a mistake to let him feel her up in the taxi one night coming back from the Hamptons this past summer. What was she thinking? She'd been between boyfriends, but still.
Not a fucking chance, she said.
But he was speaking.
Owe me $2 million, he said.
What?
She said.
He grinned, said, 20-something seconds until 1999. You bet me they'd be divorced by 1998.
Fuck you, she said.
Fuck you, Welsher, he said.
We have until the end of the year, she said.
20 seconds, Mathilde said.
Goodbye, 1998, you slow and muddy year.
There is nothing good or bad, but thinking makes it so, Lotto said drunkenly.
You speak an infinite deal of nothing, Mathilde said.
Lotto recoiled, opened his mouth, closed it.
See? Danica muttered. They're fighting. If one of them storms out, I'm calling it a win.
Mathilde snatched a glass from the tray and said,
10.
She looked at the champagne she spilled on her hand.
I'll absolve your debt if you go on a date with me, Charlie said, his hot breath in Danica's ear.
What?
Danica said.
I'm rich. You're mean, Charlie said.
Why the hell not?
8,
Mathilde said.
Because I loathe you, Danica said.
6, 5, 4, the others said. Charlie raised an eyebrow.
Okay, fine,
Danica sighed.
One, Happy New Year, they shouted, and someone gave three stomps from the apartment above, and the baby wailed, and outside they could hear the very faint noise of voices shouting all